Radio Prague News.
Mixed marks for Czechs over sustainable development, opposition to highways charges, and the golden jackal is confirmed as living now in the Czech Republic. The Czech branch of the social watchdog group Social Watch has given a mixed appreciation of the Czech Republic's moves to foster a more equitable and fairer country and world over the last year. The grouping of NGOs praised moves to increase the minimum wage and to take some steps dealing with the profiting from companies of citizens falling into debt. However, it also highlighted the government's failure to push through a bill on social housing, the continued wide gender gap on pay, and the high level of Czech arms exports to dubious regimes and low levels of overall Czech development aid. The assessment was carried out in the context of the United Nations 2030 strategy for sustainable development. Unions and employers have opposed government plans to widen roll tolls to main highways as well as the existing charges on motorways. The plan was raised at a meeting with the government on Monday. Transport employers have warned that any increase in transport costs will be passed directly on to consumers. The Transport Ministry is looking to widen tolls to around 900 kilometres of first-class highways. One of the reasons for the move is the Ministry's preparation of a new tender for charging lorries for the use of motorways. The last Czech Roma to have survived the Nazi attempts to kill the population during World War II has died at the age of 90, Czech Radio reported on Monday. The death of Emilia Machalkova was confirmed by her family. Machalkova and her family were rounded up to be taken to a concentration camp, but their lives were saved when a local mayor persuaded the Brno Gestapo to let them go. 33 relatives and members of Machalkova's family died during the Nazi attempts to kill the Roma population. Machalkova later made a name for herself as a singer of Roma songs she composed herself. Naturalists say the presence of the golden jackal has been confirmed in the Czech Republic. The confirmation follows photographs taken at a photo trap of a pregnant jackal at the Milovice Nature Reserve, situated between the town and Banatky nad Jizerou in the north of Bohemia. Sightings of jackal in the area were previously made in 2015 and 2016, but the latest proof, backed up by photos from a naturalist working in the area, has been judged to be definitive confirmation that they've settled in the Czech Republic. The jackal is common in other parts of Central Europe and the Balkans, but is believed to be extending its territory into the Czech Republic. And finally, a look at the weather. Tuesday will be cloudy with sunny intervals and the possibility of rain in the centre of the country. Top temperatures will range between 24 and 29 degrees Celsius. I'm Chris Johnston, and that was the news.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Ruth Franková. Coming up in today's programme, popular Czech street magazine hits milestone 500 issue. The number of long-term unemployed in the Czech Republic has dropped significantly. We have a roundup of the latest Czech sports news, and later Prague-based lawyer David Langwellner discusses his involvement in a project that has successfully freed hundreds of wrongly convicted people. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Nový prostor, a Czech street magazine, recently saw the publication of its milestone 500th issue. For more than 15 years, the Czech equivalent of Britain's The Big Issue has given sellers who are homeless an employment opportunity, a voice and a chance to reconnect with broader society. Jan Wellinger has more.
The sale of Nový prostor to areas in Prague and several other Czech cities outside metro stations, supermarkets and other venues has long been a common sight, and the magazine is supported by both casual buyers and return customers. Initially named Patron, Nový prostor began publication in 1999. Many buyers consider it an opportunity to support fellow citizens who have faced insurmountable difficulties that saw them end up on the streets struggling to get by. Alena is a vendor in the Czech capital trying to rebuild something like a regular life.
Prodávám nový prostor, protože jsem se dostala
I sell the magazine because I had a lot of problems, both social and health. I live in a boarding house. I suffer from diabetes and from leukemia, for which I'm being treated for free. No one will give me a job. My hope is that I can save enough and find a small place to live with my two dogs, which are my reason for staying alive.
And like others who sell Nový Prostor, Alena attempts to positively engage passers-by. And sellers all have a regular selling space, in her case near Prague's Museum Metro. And some passers-by purchase the magazine, with Alena pointing out that the latest issue is special. The reason? It's the magazine's 500th. The magazine's editor, Jan Skipanek, tells Radio Prague the latest edition is full of original content which sets it apart.
Number 500 is a big deal for us. We decided to celebrate with a special Jubilee edition, one focusing wholly on the Czech Republic. We asked current authors to write stories about the country, and we commissioned our illustrators to work on them. We also wanted to help our sellers and raise the funds to push down the regular cost. Normally, sellers buy single issues for 25 crowns and sell them for 50. In this case, we were able to push down the price to 15 crowns, thereby increasing their profit.
Around 150 or 160 people in the Czech Republic sell Nový Prostor, and the current concept, the editor-in-chief says, is to provide quality journalism on subjects which might otherwise be ignored. Currently, around 15,000 issues of the bi-monthly are sold every fortnight. And if interested, July 17th is the final day to purchase the milestone 500th issue.
Jan Wellinger with that report. The number of long-term unemployed in the Czech Republic in June was less than half the figure for the same month 3 years previously. Indeed, according to figures released by the National Office of Labour, the long-term jobless rate is way below the number of positions being offered. Ian Willoughby has the details.
In June, a total of 116,691 people in the Czech Republic had been out of work for 12 months or more. In the same month 3 years previously, that figure had been pushing close to a quarter of a million, Czech television reported, citing data from the country's Office of Labour. Indeed, the number of long-term jobless is considerably less than the number of vacancies offered by the Office of Labour. That figure stood at 183,500 in June. Lukasz Kawanda is chief analyst with the brokerage firm Cirrus. He offered this perspective to Czech television.
In terms of international comparison, the share of long-term unemployed is below average in the Czech Republic. So in that respect, it can be seen as a good sign with regard to the Czech labor market.
However, while the number of long-term jobless is on the decline, the average period that such individuals are out of work is growing. While in January the figure stood at 660 days, by last month it had grown to 745. Around 30% of the long-term unemployed have not had a job for 2 years or longer. Meanwhile, the long-term jobless account for just below 40% of all the unemployed. Many of those people have only elementary education and either don't wish to work or lack the skills to do so, suggests economist Lukasz Kawanda.
They've lost a considerable part of their working habits. They can't be quickly reintegrated into the labor market. They've lost step with the modern age as regards knowledge of information and communications technology.
The Office of Labor has put increased effort into dealing with the long-term jobless. For instance, it introduced subsidies in the first half of last year aimed at encouraging people in areas of relatively high unemployment to commute to work. To date, just over 2,300 people have availed of the scheme, which typically offers payment of 1,500 crowns a month and involves commutes of between 10 and 25 kilometres. People can also get a 50,000 crown grant to move to an area where there are more jobs, but so far fewer than 50 recipients have been approved. The overall unemployment rate in June fell to 4.0% from the previous month, and that was the lowest level recorded in the Czech Republic in 19 years.
Ian Willoughby with that report. And Ian stays in the studio with a summary of the latest Czech sports news.
We begin today with athletics and the news that the Czech Republic's Zuzana Hejnová came first in the women's 400 metres hurdles at a Diamond League meeting in the Moroccan capital Rabat on Sunday. What's more, the 30-year-old did so in her best time so far this year, 54.22 seconds. Hejnová had been struggling with the Achilles problems in recent weeks, so was extremely pleased after her success in Morocco.
I came to Rabat more or less straight from a training camp in Nymburk where I did quite a lot of work. I'm really satisfied and I believe that once I get some rest, my form will improve even further and that I'll be a lot better at the World Championships.
And with under 3 weeks to go to the World Athletics Championships in London, another Czech athlete who seems to be finding form at the right time is javelin star Barbora Špotáková. Špotáková built on a great showing in the UK capital a week earlier with another Diamond League win in Rabat. The 35-year-old's first throw of 63.73 metres on Sunday was her best and was enough to secure another victory. Tennis, and it's official, the release of the latest standings on Monday has confirmed that Karolina Plíšková is the world women's number one. The 25-year-old Czech is 185 points ahead of second-placed Simona Halep of Romania, with both having overtaken the previous number one, Angelique Kerber of Germany. Plíšková, who has yet to win a Grand Slam tournament, says she still has some room for improvement.
One area is the physical side. My movement on the court still isn't ideal, but I'm working on it and it's getting better slowly but surely. We are also trying to make my play more aggressive, and that will also take a bit of time. So everything is improving, but it just needs some time.
And the top Czech men's player, Tomáš Berdych, remains 15th in the rankings after reaching the semifinals at Wimbledon, where he was knocked out by eventual tournament winner Roger Federer. Finally, Patrick Schick's transfer from Sampdoria to Juventus for a reported €25 million at first appeared like a fairy tale for Czech soccer. But weeks later, the deal has still not gone through, after Juve's doctors still had questions following the 21-year-old's initial medical examination. Now the owner of Sampdoria, Massimo Ferrero, has dubbed the situation a fiasco and even warned that the Genoa club could sell Schick to another team. And that's all the sports news for today.
Just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. In recent years, documentaries like Making a Murderer and a number of podcasts have placed the spotlight on dubious convictions. But way before this trend, the US-based Innocence Project was working to exonerate the wrongly convicted. Prague resident David Langwellner is very active in the Innocence Project in Europe, and he is Ian Willoughby's guest in this edition of One on One.
The Innocence Project is a US-based legal organization that succeeded in getting hundreds of wrongly convicted people out of prison. The Irish barrister, teacher and writer David Langwellner, who's now based at Prague's Anglo-American University, set up an Innocence Project in his native country in 2009 and made headlines for winning a posthumous pardon for Harry Gleeson, an innocent man hanged for murder in 1941. When we spoke at Radio Prague Studios, David Langwellner first gave me some background on his organisation.
The Innocence Project was set up in 1991 by Barry Shack, Peter Nuffield and a few other people who are criminal practitioners in America, and they discovered that a lot of their clients who were in prison, particularly those in death row, were saying to them, "I didn't do it." And they talked to a lady called Kate Grimond in Centurion Ministries in Princeton, who had been lobbying successfully to get people who were wrongfully convicted out of prison. And they thought, well, this is a real problem. And it started off initially, and the New York office, which still is in effect the epicenter of the organization where Barry Shekas and Peter Nuffield are, on DNA questions. And that simply is that the DNA tests that were done 15, 20 years ago are like archaeological, they're way out of, and so new DNA tests and advances, YSTR and low carbon testing, have exonerated hundreds of people in America. But then the project widened, and this is the most interesting thing. They found out all sorts of things that are wrong with the system. Fabricated cases, police misconduct, police corruption, prosecutorial misconduct fueled by ambition. I must get a result. I'll do anything. I'll conceal evidence. I'll mislead a witness and so on. This is a real problem. And then they found there were things like falsely implanted memory systems, extremely disturbing stuff, where effectively witnesses, particularly children, are coached into having falsely implanted memories. Then there's things like faulty eyewitness identification. And what started off as a movement in America, and now there's one in every American state, has become an international organization. And I was very much instrumental. I came up with the idea of setting up the European Innocence Network because some of the cases I've been handling over the last couple of years have had a strong European dimension to them. We're thinking, well, hold on for a second. This is something that needs to be coordinated at a European level. And I had set up the Irish Project in 2009.
And does the Innocence Project mainly work with live cases, cases that are people who are still in prison today?
Yeah, but my big success so far is a dead case. And I had to resist my project telling me not to take it, and because I was responsible in Ireland for the first posthumous pardon in the history of the Irish state, a man called Harry Gleeson, which is a major issue in Ireland and raises a whole set of everything that's wrong with Ireland, both then and now. And we've had some historical cases, but the main thing is to try and get over the line people who are alive.
I understand also that part of the project involves getting law students involved.
Yeah, it's really changed my attitude in a lot of things. I said to a judge friend of mine in the Court of Appeal, I said, listen, I've got this 23-year-old Lithuanian student in my Innocence Project. You should just put her in the Supreme Court tomorrow. She's much brighter than all of them put together. And it's changed my mind because young people, A, the mind is sharper. I mean, experience is very useful for judgment, but the mind isn't as sharp. B, they devote a lot of their attention to one case. It's actually, the whole experience has slightly changed my working methods as well, which is you should only take on one or two tasks at a time. Otherwise, I mean, a lot of barristers consume themselves with doing seven or eight different things, and therefore they don't do them as well as they should. And if you're in the Innocence Project, we assign to a particular student caseworker, in a sense, carriage of a particular case. And that improves them.
And on what basis do you choose your cases? In a sense, do you have to kind of conduct your own case prior to accepting somebody?
Well, it's like the myth of Sisyphus or something. It's like rolling a rock up a hill, undoing that which has been done before. It's extremely difficult. It's like 100-to-1 shot or 1,000,000-to-1 shot. So you've got to, within the structure of the Irish Project, find something that wasn't known at the time that changes the goalposts, or something that was known at the time, the true significance of which wasn't appreciated, to get it back into the court system. And there was quite a lot of that in the Gleeson thing, and there's some of it in others. But unfortunately, we get a whole volume of cases, and it's depressing, because sometimes, like, there's this lady who's in prison, I won't mention her name for confidentiality reasons, she was accused of sexual abuse of her children, but we think she's completely innocent, but we don't know what we can do about it. And the difficulty becomes that the work is profoundly depressing at one level and very emotionally draining, simply because what you're trying to do is do the impossible. And a lot of the time you're committed to failure, but sometimes you're successful. I would like to try and lobby so that people understand what goes wrong with the system from the beginning. And so we don't have to as much do this at the end. In other words, if the Innocence Project provides an educational tool to train police officers and prosecutors as to proper levels of conduct and judges and judicial officers, that's an accomplishment, you know, to prevent all of this happening.
And roughly what percentage of the people that come to you do you accept?
Well, we have a process of assessment. We have a desktop review, a quick review, and then we share that at a committee on bank meeting. And then we work out whether we can do anything with this case. And that might involve collecting all the documents the prosecutor's file or whatever we can, what's called now in the Book of Evidence, or whatever we can collect. And then seeing from that, is there anywhere to go? Now, cases collapse at different stages. Sometimes someone says, I mean, someone came into us and said, well, it was manslaughter, but I didn't murder him. We got, no, you know, it has to be factual innocence. And then cases collapse as you go through the process of review for the purpose of ascertaining whether and to what extent you can do anything with it.
And at a personal level, what do you get out of your involvement in the project?
It's made me, I think, a nicer human being. The barrister caste of which I'm part of has tendencies towards arrogance, which I'm not oblivious to, of course. But if you see people who are in such anguish and pain, not only are they in a prison cell, and I have done a lot of criminal work, so it's not like I lack the empathy skills, but they have the added burden of being wrongfully there in the first place. And I've met some people in very bad situations. So I think it's humbled me and changed me. I didn't set out to get that out of it. I find that the work very emotionally rewarding. I find that what's been done is a contribution to humanity. And it's led to a lot of papers I've written educationally about lawyers and a documentary I'm supposed to be doing about lawyers. What good do we do? What bad do we do? I mean, I regard corporate lawyer firms as basically criminals in some respects, in terms of what they do to the planet, to humanity. And a lot of lawyers are crooks. A lot of lawyers are fabricators. A lot of lawyers have no ethics. They think they do, or they play the game. It's a game to them, the justice game, as Jeffrey Robertson QC says. But this stuff is kind of pure and clean at one level. And I think what I get out of it, apart from it humbling me, is I get out of it a sense that I'm doing something worthwhile, even if I'm killing myself financially and physically in the process.
In recent times, there have been quite a few podcasts, documentaries about people who are wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
Does that help you? Does that help when it heightens awareness among the public?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of there are a lot of documentaries, and there's a lot of journalists associated with the project. And there's a kind of real crime appeal. I wasn't really aware of this at the beginning. I mean, when I took the Gleeson case, for example, in Ireland, and had to persuade my committee to take it, I didn't realise there was a whole literature about it, a whole fame attached to it, and then a whole afterlife attached to it. All of that is good because the press are on our side. And really, I think I just want to compliment the press in general about this, because the legal system is not necessarily a temple of justice. I've reached that shattering realisation at all sorts of levels. It will convict an innocent person. And then it will, as in the Birmingham Six or Guildford Four, and there are many other examples in Ireland, it will do its best to cover up its own corruption, incompetence, and stupidity. And the literature of all the cinema and documentaries shines a light in these things, because journalists tend to be tenacious and they don't let go of certain things. But on the other hand, the culture of celebrity with the Innocence Project, I feel a little unsettling, you know, because it is an important human rights issue, but it's only one of many human rights issues and one of many I'm interested in and have written about.
You were telling me, David, that you moved to Prague last August.
I did, yes.
What brought you here?
A combination of circumstances. I was absolutely physically exhausted because I was combining teaching the project and practice work at a very high level and doing a lot of travel. I've been doing too much travel since I've been here. So I needed a break and also my academic development as well. And I found it hugely refreshing. It's a beautiful, lovely city. Culturally sophisticated. It's a fabulous place, the Anglo-American University, and it's been a rewarding time for me. The other thing is that the European network is in Milan now, and we're going to, I think, have an office of the European network in Prague. And I'd like to spend a lot of the rest of my career, apart from writing papers and doing representation, doing international innocence work. And Prague is a useful place. Plus, the other thing is, my father's Austrian, and my relatives are in Salzkammergut, and it's 4.5 hours away, and I can go walking and swimming. And as you get a little older, those are important things to have.
Prague-based lawyer David Langwellner was Ian Willoughby's guest in that edition of One on One. And that brings us to the end of our programme here on Radio Prague. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be glad to hear from you. But that's all for now from me, Ruth Frankova. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.